Thank you very much, Fani, and I very much appreciate the invitation to come to give a talk to ISIS. It's been a long time since I've been here, and I can see it's improved. It's got some really good. It's always had an important role to play, I think, in terms of research in ASEAN, and I've always appreciated that. And today I would like to talk a bit about the TPP and Asia-Pacific integration, these mega trends that we're seeing. And I will try to keep the talk to maybe 40 minutes, and then we can open up for questions, because I think that I'm going to try to put a lot of ideas on the table, and some of the ideas may be controversial, and one of my motivations for being here to give you the talk is to get this sort of input. This work that we're doing is part of a joint project with Peter Petrie at Brandeis University and Fan Cai, who's at the China Investment Corporation. So it's we've been working on this project for 3 years now. It's been quite a while. And we are going to have a revised paper. There's an existing working paper, but a revised paper next month, and have plans to publish a book on the topic, which will be published by the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, hopefully in early fall, if everything goes well and all of the data converge in the simulation. But anyway, so I should mention, to start anyway, some of the takeaways from what I hope to take away from this discussion, that this Asia-Pacific Cooperative Initiative, the TPP, is a very large-scale project. It's covering a great deal of territory that leads it to be complicated negotiations on par with, say, the Doha Development Agenda, and then some. It's a very, very extensive agreement. I should mention that as we go through here, we're not just going to be looking at the TPP track. There's obviously also an Asian track. But I think the focus is going to be the TPP, since we've just finished our 11th negotiating round. In our results, we find that all of the TPP track members benefit from the agreement in terms of the economics, overall economics. And small emerging economies like Malaysia tend to benefit the most. And even though Malaysia is a very open economy, this is one of the results we come up with, and we can talk about why shortly. The APEC endorsed TPP and Asian tracks, and by endorsed, perhaps that is the wrong word. What I mean by is, shall I say, sanctioned. At the Yokohama Summit of APEC in November 2010, when, you remember, 2010 was supposed to be the year that we'd have an open region of trade and investment for developed countries in APEC, and that was a slight understatement. And the idea was, okay, how are we going to do this? And the agreement was, okay, let's try to create a free trade area of the Asia-Pacific. And it sort of sanctioned two approaches to this. One would be an Asian track, and one would be a Trans-Pacific track. And so what we do here is we are, by endorsed here, it should be maybe sanctioned, that these two tracks towards the FTAAP, tend to be complementary in the longer term. And then we'll see a contest of templates that actually could be very positive. Okay? We also find that a rigorous Trans-Pacific Partnership template increases the gains that would ultimately accrue from a free trade area of the Asia-Pacific. This shouldn't be surprising. Very frequently, we see that the more ambitious the agreement, the greater the gains that tend to accrue to them. And I think some of that is here, and we'll see why this would be even better along the Trans-Pacific track than the Asian track. Okay. It's also true that when we do our calculations, that the vast majority of the benefits that accrue tend to be net welfare gains. In other words, they do not accrue due to the fact at the expense of other countries. In other words, in economic parlance, it's trade creation and not trade diversion. There's very, very little trade diversion that goes along with the TPP. And yet there's a great deal of trade creation we get from the models. In fact, in some cases, we find that the numbers suggest that integration, despite discrimination, can actually be good for non-partners. One quick example would be in the Asian track, when you have, we'll assume that China, Japan, and Korea form an agreement this year that gets expanded into an East Asian free trade area in 2015. When this takes place, we estimate that the United States actually gains from that, because the degree of discrimination is low, yet the benefits from higher growth rates in East Asia due to the East Asian integration are overwhelming. So actually, it's small, but there's actually a positive effect. Okay, so the fact that these are outward-looking agreements, or at least proposed to be outward-looking agreements, actually shows that the net gains tend to be trade-creating rather than trade-diverting. And then we also find, and we're still doing some of the simulations on this, that the dynamic effects, such as changes in investment, are very important for the story. Okay. Very briefly, why is the TPP important? In this paper that we have, we focus on three things. First is the idea that we need to re-energize global trade policy to move beyond the 8th ministerial conference of the WTO that ended up shelving Doha. It's probably not a good way to put it, move beyond Doha, because Doha is still there. It's just not moving, really. And guess what? It's not going to move for a while. It certainly isn't going to move this year, given all of the political campaigns going on. I think in the most optimistic scenarios, it would start up again mid-next year, which is a long time in trade policy terms. So that's important. It can create a dynamic, a policy dynamic, based on like-minded partners. All the TPP members are outwardly oriented economies. They have the same approach to economic development, and so therefore that at the margin anyway makes some of the negotiations easier, the orientation. And thirdly, they avoid, having these regional approaches, avoid the inefficiencies associated with bilateral arrangements. There's an old debate between whether or not we should just focus on multilateral liberalization, or if we should allow for regional trading arrangements which have the possibility of discrimination or trade diversion or something like that. And there's always been a debate on that. But whatever your feelings are on that debate, I think that we could agree that certainly a regional agreement would be better than a bilateral agreement, because a regional agreement allows for consolidation, allows for accumulation of rules of origin, which can be a problem in these arrangements. It should increase the utilization of preferences and such. So it could get this, what has been deemed the Asian noodle bowl, could be somewhat mitigated. The noodles could be straightened out some with this kind of approach. Okay, secondly, it allows for deeper Asia-Pacific economic linkages. It should increase growth, help with job creation due to the positive economic effects of the arrangements. It could support this U.S. pivot towards Asia. As many of you know, for example, the Obama administration has increased his priority on Asia, and I think that's something very welcome in the region. And as somebody that's worked on U.S.-ASEAN relations beginning in 1988 with Tan Sri, Dr. Singh, and others, I'm very much in support of that, but I really do think it's important and welcome by the region. Okay? And I think it could complement and influence other types of Asian FTAs. I think both tracks are going to be complementary to each other. And finally, it could present a 21st century template. I know that term is thrown around a lot, okay? But on the one hand, it's comprehensive and behind the border. And I must say that there must be a bit of tension among policymakers about how to do this. You want to have a great agreement. You've got very enthusiastic trade officials that want to come up with a good agreement. So the question you ask yourself is, do you want to make it a a golden rule sort of agreement where you come up with the very, very best possible agreement when you know that no one else is going to join in, ever? Or do you have to what degree do you compromise to say, okay, we can't have a perfect agreement, but let's not make the best the enemy of the good, let's get the best agreement and still make it 21st century. That's a tension I'm sure that's playing out at the negotiating rounds. But it is important in the 21st century to look at behind-the-border issues. If, for example, in this region we're very interested in supporting global value chains and such things, certainly you would want to, you have to get at behind-the-border issues. Services has become a very important part of all of our economies, and yet services trade has not risen relative to commodity trade over time. Why is this? Well, it tends to be a sector that's much more protected. How do you liberalize services? They're behind the border measures, et cetera. Okay? Also, as I mentioned, it would consolidate this noodle bowl, and it is embracing rising sectors, new sectors, such as technology, services, investment, and other sectors that may not have, maybe thought of being as softer in terms of economics, but a little less important part of the package, such as small and medium-sized enterprises, development, and some countries' labor and the environment. Okay. As many of you know, these trade arrangements in Asia and the Pacific have been rising rapidly. The red shows the, in aggregate, the Asia-Pacific trade agreements rising over time, and in the blue would be the Trans-Pacific arrangements that have been taking place. In our study, the number of existing arrangements that we consider, in other words, before the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Asian track, is 47. So it's quite a few. That's quite a few agreements that we see here, a lot in that noodle bowl. Okay. And if you look at these agreements, if you look at these trends, and how different they are, remember, we're going to be interested in modeling what the effects of a Trans-Pacific track or an Asia-Pacific track, Asian track would be. How do you sort of anticipate what those tracks would look like? Well, one way to do it is based on what happened in the past. So what we did is we looked at the past agreements, we tried to get a proxy for, you know, how often we've seen these agreements, something on state-owned enterprises or technical barriers to trade or trade remedies and everything. We look at this and we try to use that as a way of forecasting what would happen in the future. But what we end up seeing is, if you look at these numbers, is in this database we've created, that you'd see in, say, U.S. arranged agreements that they tend to be much more comprehensive than many of the Asian agreements. That's not always true. For example, in certain areas, like in dispute settlement, you get more sections, more chapters in Asian agreements than you would in U.S. agreements. But on the whole, you see them much more frequently cited. Okay, so what we're going to see when we go forward is that the TPP template is going to be deeper than the Asian one. Okay. Now, what we're going to try to do is put in some numbers to these tracks about what's going on with the, to try to inform our discussion of the TPP and the Asian track. And what we do is we use a computable general equilibrium model, which will be familiar to many of you that have looked at trade policy in the past. This is the favorite way that economists sort of try to estimate the effects of trade agreements, because it allows us to show not just something that would look at one sector or one area. It allows us to bring everything together, links economies globally together. And in our model, what we do is we use a very modern CGE model that brings in a lot of the new advances in trade theory in a model that has got 18 sectors and 24 regions. And I'll show that later. By 24 regions, by regions we could also mean countries. So we're interested in focusing on the TPP countries. So each TPP country would be one region, if you will. But some, you know, the European Union, we're not interested so much in what happens to Germany or to France. We'll just put EU in a group, right? So we're looking at 24 regions just to keep it manageable. Otherwise, our tables would have, you know, what is it, 232 countries in the world. It's not going to It's not going to be very good. Besides, it would be difficult to get the model to converge. So 18 sectors, 24 regions. We calculate an annual baseline from the year 2010 to 2025. Let me spend a moment on this because it's kind of important in the model. By baseline, we have to say, okay, if we do the TPP, you know, what would have happened if there were no TPP? What would the world look like? Often with these models, you might see people say, okay, well, the TPP will be done in 2025. You know, we've got 2010, so let's look what the world looks like in 2010 and compare it to 2025. But we're not interested in that. We're interested in looking on an annual basis, because if we're looking at a progression of TPP 9 countries, and the agreement stays in for 5 years, TPP, you know, an expansion to TPP, et cetera, you need to have an annual basis. So what we do is we project the economies in the region and globally from 2010 to 2025. Until 2015, we use IMF forecasts, and from 2015 to 2025, we use forecasts done by an institute in France called FEPI that is famous for this. So we've got projections for the economy through 2025, okay? What is more important, I think, is the second part of this baseline, is that we include all existing free trade areas in the model, in the baseline, so that we do not bias the numbers in favor of getting bigger results for the TPP or the Asian trend. Let me give an example. There's a Korean-U.S. agreement that's already been signed. That's going to generate positive returns, right? We don't want to see those numbers in our model because the TPP isn't responsible for the Korea-U.S. agreement. We just want to look at the incremental value of the TPP. So what we do is, any agreement that is still implementing the accords, we project that implementation in the baseline, including CORUS, including U.S.-Korea. So what we're able to show when we make our net effects is we take out those numbers. So we're only looking at the value added of the TPP, and we're only looking at the value added of the Asian track. That took a long time, by the way. It took us like a year to get this baseline the way we wanted it, because otherwise you're going to have inflated numbers. Okay. This sort of approach we use allows us to simulate the effects of new agreements. We include tariffs, but we're also able to have a methodology to include non-tariff barriers in goods, non-tariff barriers in services, and barriers to foreign direct investment. And finally, we add investment effects. The numbers I will be showing you for most of this presentation include investment effects, but they're not in the paper that is hopefully will be made available because we haven't finished revising that paper yet. That will be in April. But most of the numbers I'll be giving you will have the investment effects already put in. Okay. So this, in some ways, is a contribution in terms of the approach, is that we're using a state-of-the-art CGE model. The baseline is going to conclude FTAs that have already been negotiated or being implemented. We do not assume that barriers are completely removed. We only assume they're partially removed. We don't believe that it's possible, for example, to remove all non-tariff barriers in goods or services. Even if you have the best agreement you can possibly come up with, a trade agreement is not going to be able to change everything. Services is about foreign direct investment, for example. Foreign direct investment isn't just about trade policy, right? It's about investment policy. It's about a lot of other things. So we're going to assume that at the most, you could touch two-thirds of those, not 100%. So we sort of reduce the number, the effect, to be in something more realistic. We don't assume either that all tariffs are reduced 100%, because we know from previous arrangements that they're not reduced 100%. We always have exceptions to the rules. So we include those. Okay. We also assume in this model that preferences are only partially utilized. I'm sure you've heard of this. This is a new thing that we talk about in ASEAN, for example, that people that don't like AFTA will say, oh, well, AFTA utilization rates are only about 10%. First of all, it's very difficult to come up with those numbers. And secondly, that's a pretty natural thing. If most trade in ASEAN is in electronics and in petroleum, why would you use AFTA preferences, right? You wouldn't use them. right? Because you just use the MFN. So it's not a bad thing that you've got these preferences, but we know that these utilization rates are low, and they could be due to the fact that you have bureaucracy and things. So in this model, what we assume is that preferences are only partially utilized, but the bigger the arrangements, the more you utilize them. Because the bigger the region, the bigger the incentive to utilize them. Okay, on a bilateral it would be less, but on a regional one it would be more. And finally, in the model, we include costs associated with rules of origin. Now, rules of origin mean that, you know, a certain percentage of a product has to be produced within the region. And this has been the most heavily criticized feature of free trade areas. It's a necessary feature of free trade areas. You have to have rules of origin, but there's been abuses associated with it. And it's heavily criticized, and it can distort things. So there's a big cost associated with rules of origin, possibly. But whatever that cost is, we assume it's going to be less in a regional arrangement. Because if you're able to source from a bigger region, the cost of the bilateral rules of origin are less. More importantly, in this region where we're looking to build regional production networks, how could bilateral agreements do their job? A regional arrangement would do a better job at that. Okay? So I should mention that in these things, when we look at non-tariff barriers, and et cetera, and we look at this idea of rows, we assume that they're like an iceberg, we say in economics. You know, something preventing us from getting all the gains that we need to gain. It's a piece of ice that separates us from what could be and what is, okay, due to high non-tariff barriers, due to rules of origin. And then when we join the agreement, we allow the iceberg to melt. Not completely, only melts partially. How much does it melt? Well, it depends on the agreement, depends on the template. The deeper the template, the more melt you get. But we're modeling it that way. It's something that's going to be an iceberg that will melt, and this is how we get a lot of our effects. And so, just to give an example of why that's important, on the Asian track, we go from this year, as I mentioned, the CJK agreement in 2012, to a East Asian free trade area in 2015, which would be recognizable as an ASEAN plus 3 free trade area. If we're only interested in tariffs, moving from the CJK to the East Asian free trade area would have no effect. Because there's already an ASEAN already has a free trade area with China, it's got a free trade area with Japan, it's got a free trade area with Korea. If all we're interested in with tariffs, we're going to get almost no effect. In this model, though, you could get a very big effect because you would get higher utilization rates, you'd get lower rules of origin costs, and you'd have perhaps a deeper agreement. So even though it's not tariffs causing it, you've got a lot of the benefits from consolidation that you get in the agreement. Okay, so these are features of the model. So the different simulations we use are, as I mentioned, they're going to be tariffs, would be reduced, utilization rates of preferences will be increased, non-tariff barriers will be partially reduced, and will lower costs associated with rules of origin. Okay. So, what we need to do for non-tariff barriers is we need to have a way of quantifying how much a certain chapter in a free trade area affects that iceberg. Okay? Or, in other words, how including the chapter could help melt the iceberg. Now, if you look at the chapters, I mean, we have 24 topics in the TPP, for example. They've got a lot of things that would be very difficult to quantify in that regard, like science and technology, culture, SMEs. How are you going to estimate these? And because you can't estimate very well, usually CG models ignore them. But they have some effect, right? Culture would have some effect on services we include, or could have some effect. So what we do is, we go through all the agreements, we look at the chapters that include in these agreements these various things, and then we assign a score. And we use that score as a way of trying to melt this iceberg. How much it melts the iceberg depends on what kind of weights we give to them. Customs, culture gets a very, very low weight, 4% in services. So only 4% of the services iceberg is going to be culture. So it's very, very small, but it's in there. Intellectual property is going to be in there. It's hard to estimate, to quantify, but we include this in this big FTA database we have and we had these policy effects. So these are just some examples of what these scores would look like in the various agreements, where, for example, in the ASEAN-China agreement, you have about 50% in technical barriers relative to what would be, you know, a total inclusion. You've got nothing in government procurement, so this would be completely new to that. So we wouldn't assume that in an ASEAN track that you would expect much on government procurement, etc. Whereas if you look at the CORUS agreement, we get much more in the area of technical barriers and government procurement, and investment is there, but nothing on, say, science, technology, and cooperation. I should mention that in the scorecard, when we're looking at these things, there are two items that enter in negatively. You know, we assume that greater protection of intellectual property will increase trade. It will also increase investment. So including it, tightening it up, leads that iceberg to fall. Technical barriers to trade, the extent they improve, should lead barriers to fall. Tighter labor restrictions, no matter what your view is on labor restrictions, it's hard to think about how tighter labor restrictions could lead to an increase in trade. As a matter of fact, we could easily come up with an assumption that it could lead to a slight decrease in trade. So for labor and the environment, inclusion is, you know, they may very well be justified to be there, but we assume that there's going to be a very, very small negative effect from the labor and the environmental cap, because you can't think about how tighter controls on the environment, for example, is going to stimulate trade. Okay. So, and to give you an idea of some of the scenario changes, we assume, looking at the literature and based on our best estimates of agreement, like a developed agreement like the Korea-U.S. agreement, we assume that there is a 50% utilization rate in the Korea agreement as we implement it in that baseline. And that's much higher than it's been estimated for ASEAN, but, you know, even after, they say it's starting to rise quite a bit. So we're also proving that the TPP, which is going to be based on these past U.S. agreements, because it's going to be a larger agreement, would be a 58% utilization rate of the tariffs, of tariffs and preferences. And the FTAP, which is even larger, would have a higher one, so of 67%, which is we assume to be the highest. You can see here we've got final tariffs, which in all scenarios we assume to be high, but not 100%. And for the our estimates, and we've got a way of quantifying this for the goods NTBs, services NTBs, and FDI barriers, tend to be on the order of 0.4 to 0.54, but we always assume that you could never go beyond 67%, as I mentioned earlier. So this is what we're doing. Okay, so as I mentioned, the TPP scenario starts off with the 9 currently negotiating partners. We assume that this will extend to include Canada, Japan, Korea, and Mexico in 2015. Now, we came out with this paper in October of 2011, I might say, before the Honolulu summit, at which Japan, Canada, and Mexico said they would like to join the negotiations at some point, and are now being discussed. Okay. So we were happy to at least anticipate 3 out of 4 so soon coming in. We didn't have that through inside information, but rather sort of read the literature and hopefully keeping fingers crossed, I guess. But we also assume, though, that if under the logic that even now in rerunning the regressions that Korea will join if Japan comes in and if this keeps going through. So I think that's not so out there that if we get a TPP in 2012 of the 9 countries that are currently negotiating, that in 2015 we could get these additional 4. Then we assume in 2020 we go to a free trade area of the Asia Pacific with 21 APEC economies. Now, remember, we've got this Trans-Pacific track, which is what this TPP scenario says towards the free trade area of the Asia Pacific. We've got the Asian track, which would be CJK this year, East Asian Free Trade Area in 2015, and then we go to the FTAAP. But please remember that we always go to the same membership. We always go to the FTAAP, but there are different templates. Because of our research on past agreements, etc., we assumed the TPP agreement would be deeper and more comprehensive than from the Asian track. So the question is, which will dominate? And by the way, the numbers, we do everything. We do what would happen if it was strictly an Asian track, if it was strictly TPP track, or an average of the two, which is probably more realistic. But okay. Now, to go through the numbers relatively quickly, what we see are generally, certainly for these models, these types of models, overall positive gains, pretty large gains for the TPP. Of the order of for the TPP economies, $200 billion worth, which in for the TPP and for the FTAP, $512 billion. Which would be 1.5% of all TPP economies. Okay, now, remember what's happening here. We're putting together a lot of very liberal economies. So these are actually pretty big numbers that are being mainly driven by that reduction of this iceberg I was talking about, and reduction of rules of origin, better utilization rates, etc. Malaysia is one of the countries that gains the most. As a matter of fact, it gains its gains are only second to Vietnam. As a percentage of GDP, TPP would lead to an increase of 2.7% in Malaysia and 6% with the FTAAP, which are very, very large numbers. I know if I were a trade negotiator, I want higher numbers if I'm interested in the TPP. But I tell you, if we got higher numbers and you were, you know, professional, any professional economists in the crowd are going to say, how could you possibly get such high numbers? And so, what we've tried to do here is be very, very conservative, so we're very comfortable that these are not overestimates anyway. And my own view is they probably have some downward biases. As I mentioned at the outset, the smaller economies get the largest gains, Chile, Malaysia, Peru, and especially Vietnam. Vietnam, obviously, is going to gain the most from this because it doesn't have a free trade area with, for example, the United States, and it's still a very protected economy. And it could gain a lot from liberalization. So Vietnam gets very, very big big estimates, and Malaysia comes in second in this roundup. And as I mentioned, there isn't very much in terms of trade diversion in this. Okay, in just looking at the TPP numbers, it doesn't make sense in this regard to look at the FTAAP, because in this table we don't have the Asian track countries. With the TPP, we get gains to the TPP economies of $200 billion, and the negative effect on outsiders is only $27 billion, which is essentially, you know, insignificant, so trivial. So the vast majority of the gains from the TPP are simply going to be welfare improving effects and not at the cost of outside economies. Okay. Income gains from Malaysia over time looks something like this. We've got a TPP track, we've got both tracks, and we've got a an Asian track here. Remember, for the Asian track, Malaysia would only start to benefit after 2015 because that's when we get the East Asian Free Trade Area. And before 2015, Malaysia slightly is disadvantaged because of through preference erosion and perhaps trade diversion due to the CJK agreement. So you see along this red thing, this is both, you see it's slightly below the TPP track because of the of that effect. But then when the East Asia Agreement kicks in, the benefits of Malaysia start to rise. If we only stayed along the TPP in Malaysia, this is what we would get. So if we don't go to the free trade of the Asia Pacific, we still get positive numbers. They're still relatively significant. We're talking about over 2% of GDP, not insignificant. But we could triple those numbers as we go to the FTAAP. So we think of the TPP as being something that is a short-run thing, that is this process of a pathway to the free trade area Asia-Pacific. We get benefits during the short-term approach, short-medium term, and the long-term, the FTAAP, we get much bigger increases in benefits over time. So TPP generates a lot of benefits, but FEAP is much bigger. Now, at the sectoral level, we see from an export's point of view that three sectors gain the most. Food and beverages, machinery, and other manufacturers have the biggest positive effects. There's one very marginal negative effect, which is, you know, a contraction of $100 million in textiles. So, in general, we've got three sectors that gain a lot. We've got one sector that contracts slightly, and the others sort of fall in between the two. The net gain of the TPP of Malaysia is a $16 billion increase in exports. Along with TPP, it would be a $29 billion increase in exports. Now, in terms of imports, we see that there's an increase in other agriculture of $3 billion, a big increase in textiles of $4 billion, and an increase in private services of $4.2 billion. So these are the three big ones. I'd like to point out two things. Let me point out one thing in particular, that we have to be careful in calculating any balances here, because it is not a coincidence that the total increase in trade, for example, in the TPP is $16 billion, and the total increase in imports is $16 billion. The model forces this. You can't import additional foreign savings. It's just the model just can't do it. And so what we have to do is we have to assume that essentially the current account balance is going to be constant. So we've got a big increase in exports, but the exports are also being met by an increase in imports. So what is more interesting here is the fact that we've got a big increase in trade relative to the rest of the economy, is an important way of looking at it. And secondly, this gives you an idea of what the structural change is. Because even though we're forced to have this balance in trade, if you will, and no change in the net trade, we're able to calculate these balances. So this is essentially what's going on in the economy. Okay, to look at this in the wider frame of all countries, looking at, let's say, percentage of GDP export gains, we see that, again, the biggest gainer is, the biggest winner is Vietnam, which wins a lot for the reasons I mentioned earlier. Peru gains 11%. Malaysia falls somewhat middle of the pack of 5% of GDP, which is not insignificant. Remember, there's 5% of GDP above and beyond everything else. Right? This is just due to the TPP, and about 9% due to the FTAAP. As a whole, TPP economies have growth of exports of 4%, and with the FTAAP, about 12%. Okay. I don't want to talk too much about foreign direct investment, but we do estimate foreign direct investment and put it into these models. And what we'll see here is that this would be outward FDI abroad. And we see that Malaysia has an increase in its outward FDI by about 2.6% of GDP. So actually, Malaysia, during this period, ends up becoming an increasingly more important exporter of DFI. But if you look at it from an inward FDI, you're going to get less of an effect. But the reason why you get less of an effect in the inward part is the way that we've estimated the gains from FDI. We estimate the gains of FDI is how countries are coming towards the envelope. The closer you get the envelope, the more the gains will be. But if you're already at the envelope, if you're already very open to foreign direct investment, if you already have a large stock of foreign direct investment, in the country, you don't have as much to gain because you're already there, right? So you don't see a big effect there. Whereas a country like Japan, which is very close to foreign direct investment, has much less foreign direct investment than you'd ever predict, you actually get very big increases in inward foreign direct investment, okay? But we're going to have these investment flows. They're positive, but interestingly, in the case of Malaysia, you get outward investment that increases somewhat bigger than inward FDI. To give you, and I think this is the last data thing, we see these gives you the world gains only looking at trade. Previous tables had investment, We haven't had this world gains yet, including investment. So this would just be gains in trade only. This is what they would look like over time. Along the Asian track, it would look like this. If you didn't do the FCAAP, you would just go along this. Ultimately, you wouldn't get that big of gains. Yet the FCAAP along the FCAAP Asian track leads to big gains here. Okay. However, the TPP looks like this. So the TPP ends up, if you don't go to the FCAAP, ends up with less gains than even the East Asian Free Trade Area. The reason being that in the East Asian Free Trade Area, protection is much higher, so they gain much more from liberalization. The TPP countries are much more open, so they gain less. However, when we go to a FTAAP using the TPP template, we get much greater gains, almost $1 trillion in trade only, compared to the Asian track, which would give us about $700 billion. Let me explain why this is interesting. China, for example, gains more, gets a larger share of the pie, of the gains, on the Asian track TPP, the Asian track FTAAP. In other words, if we use the parameters established in the East Asian track, China gets a larger share of the pie than it would under the TPP track. Yet, under the TPP template, the pie gets so much larger that the smaller slice that China gets is bigger than the slice it gets on the Asian track. Okay, so what we see here is that China in the TPP track, given its structural transformation, given its new interests that take place over time in a rapidly changing economy, actually gains more from deeper integration than the shallow integration that it's engaged in so far. This is what we get from the model anyway. But also we should mention that the United States doesn't have as big of gains, but its gains going from simply the TPP, which are positive, to the FTAAP, essentially quadruple. It gets much more. So the idea here is that, okay, you've got this TPP that's being led by the U.S., whose economy, by the way, is bigger than all the other economies combined, and then we've got this Asian track, which seems to be led by China. We get the biggest gains when the U.S. and China come together in the FTAAP, essentially. Because those are going to be the last two economies to not have an agreement together. Right? So there's going to be a strong incentive for investing in one's track, but also, in the end, in merging these tracks. And by the way, I'm not talking about something that should be happening in 2030 or 2040. 2020 is 8 years away, which, you know, is, for negotiations, is, you know, not that far. That's pretty fair, yeah. So, making a lot of work for our trade negotiators. Okay. I've spoken too long, but I just wanted to go into one more point, and that would regard the costs of these agreements. Now, we have to ask ourselves, why is it that, I'm sure this isn't true of people in this room, but why is it that when you go outside this room, people tend to have a negative impression of trade? I don't know about Malaysia, but that's the case. I guarantee you if we're in Washington, D.C., they would, or in Rome, Italy, or in Paris, France. Some reason, trade has this very negative connotation to it. And why is it that when the global crisis recently hit, every G7 summit, every G8 summit, every G20 summit, every GM summit, has to say we're going to resist protectionism in all its forms, right? Well, the reason being is that people believe that trade is bad for jobs. I would argue that this is something that we see. You hit a recession, people are nervous about jobs, they want to go towards protection. So the effect on employment is going to be important. So we ask ourselves in this exercise, what are going to be the costs? This is a long-run model. But what is going to be the cost per labor? It may be that labor gains, but it may be that labor loses, certain areas of lose. That we saw, for example, that in the case of Malaysia, exports of machinery rise, but exports of textiles fall slightly. So some textile workers are going to have to move to the machinery sector. That doesn't you know, when I teach my students, I could take, it takes me 2 seconds to do that on the blackboard. But, you know, in reality, it takes a while because not all textile workers are born knowing how to use work in the machinery sector. It's going to take time to train them, to reintegrate them. The economy, it depends on what the economy is, but certainly this is an important cost. So you want to ask yourself the question, and this is why we ask the self question in this paper, how big are the gains per job shift? You know, we can calculate how many jobs shift, and we calculate what welfare is. So we'll put welfare in the numerator, we'll put job shifts in the denominator, and we'll calculate what the gains are per job. Okay, to give us at least some idea if this is going to be worth it. You know, if we could, because if it's small, if you've got, okay, we get welfare gains, but it's $10,000 per job, in the U.S., that would be very, very costly. It might not be worth it. But if we get high numbers, that would suggest that at least from this point of view, it makes sense. We've only done this exercise for the U.S. thus far. And the numbers we get are actually very, very high. Very, very high, particularly in the early years where you don't have much structural transformation, much job shifts until later on in the agreement. But we get, in the first year, about $1 million per job shift. $1 million per job shift, which is very, very high. Okay, and over time, as structural adjustment takes place, we get that denominator starts to rise, whereas the numerator doesn't rise as much on an annual basis. And so it falls, but it ends up reaching a steady state of about $200,000 per job. If in the United States you assume that workers, on average, are going to be making $50,000 a year, this is four times that in a steady state. So the idea here would be, yes, you come up with the right compensation mechanism and approach, these agreements should be enough for that kind of a compensation. So that's another aspect. We've only done this for the U.S., but when we publish our final book, we'll be doing it for other countries as well. So to conclude, what are the key positive implications? The TPP should generate substantial gains for the region, with big net gains for the world and little trade diversion. The deeper the accord, the greater these gains will be. The distribution of gains should be pro-convergence, with generally poorer countries gaining more than the richer ones, as well as the fact that small economies gain more than larger ones. The TPP should give a big boost to production networks. I haven't talked that much about it in the talk, but we go into detail in the paper about it. The cost of structural adjustment should be easily manageable, as I mentioned, just governments have to pay attention to it. And the policy dynamics post-8th ministerial conference of the WTO should be significant. And the reason I say it should be significant is because I think that we're already, you know, seeing it. We saw in the case of the Uruguay round, for example, that, as many of you recall, we were talking about this morning, that in the Uruguay round actually died 2 deaths. The reason why some people weren't so nervous about the Doha Development Agenda in Cancun in 2003 that fell apart is because, you know, the Uruguay round died 2 deaths as well. It died a death in December 1990, which led Prime Minister Mahathir to talk about, you know, suggest an East Asian economic bloc. And it died again in December of 1992. And then what happened? And most of it was because the U.S. was pushing the EU on agricultural reform. And so President Clinton did something that was very interesting. He invited all the APEC leaders to the United States to have a summit. And to give a metaphor, he took a picture and sent it to Brussels and said, look, if you don't want to do a deal at Doha, fine. I will go with my Asian friends that, by the way, are growing at about 5 times the rate you are and 3 times the rate they are in Africa, right? And then all of a sudden, they were back at the negotiating table when something went through. This has sometimes been called as competitive liberalization. You can bet, and I just finished 2 years of the OECD, and I could see this in some quarters, that if the TPP goes through and the CJK goes through, you can bet that the rest of the world is going to take notice, and it will be a very strong incentive to go back to the multilateral table. I'm speculating, of course, but I'm seeing it. And I would argue, and we're talking about this also this morning, I would also argue that the probability of a CJK agreement, which 5 or 10 years ago was unthinkable, really, is actually much higher. You heard more about this to talk earlier. but it's still, I would argue, at the margin, it's much higher now that you've got the TPP that's gone through 11 successful negotiations. You can imagine that the, you know, China, Japan, and Korea, which at this point are not in that track, would be interested in, look, maybe we should do something ourselves as well. So you could have a very interesting political dynamic going on there as well. But being an economist, I won't go too far into that. So thank you for your patience.